The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We're continuing our coverage of the mobile space this week, rounding out 2011 by dissecting the business decisions that are affecting the handheld market close to home and in far-flung locations. Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, speaks with BlackBerry makers Rim, ad delivery company Adgent, and app developers Peter Swain from Always On Message and Tom Curtis from BlueVia. And Charles, you're in the studio, so I don't have to refer to you in third person anymore. Welcome.
Hello.
And how are you this week?
I'm good.
You're good because you've got good news. You delivered the proofs to your publisher this week.
I did, of the book that I've been working over all this year and researching for about 15 years.
What's the title of the book?
Digital Wars. Ooh. Apple, Microsoft and Google and the Battle for the Internet.
15 years you've been...
Well, in effect, you know, I've been sort of meeting these guys for however long. Bill Gates, I think I first met him in 1990-umpty-ump.
that was a very good year, good vintage.
It was a very good year.
Well, we will definitely be interviewing you next year about it. But when is it finally coming out?
Early March 2012, but you can find it on well-known online bookstores if you search on Digital Wars.
Well, congratulations, Charles. And before we dive into the here and now, next week we are finishing 2011 up with our annual Christmas show. Of course, you can expect the usual round of chaos and bloopers. Thank you very much, producer Scott, who is nodding emphatically in the booth. However, if you would like to add your tuppence to what you think are the top stories of 2011 and not the top bloopers, then do tweet us at GuardianTW or go to guardian.co.uk/techweekly to find out how else you can contribute. And now, with the now, keep listening to Tech Weekly for this week's news from The Guardian. After a long period of to-ing and fro-ing, HP has finally made the decision about what's to happen to its webOS operating system. WebOS was up for the chop when former HP CEO Leo Apotheker restructured the company earlier this year, pulling out of PCs and mobile. However, Meg Whitman swiftly replaced him at the top of the pile within a matter of months and set about restructuring the company her way. WebOS development was put on ice and scores of top developers left the project, fleeing like it was going out of fashion. It was expected that HP might can WebOS, which it originally bought from Palm in April 2010, or even sell it on to a mobile manufacturer like HTC. But last Friday, Whitman decided to open source the software and let it go live. So, Charles, it's open source, but HP aren't going to use it in 2012. Is this not just death by another name?
I think John Gruber of Daring Fireball put it best. He said, this is sort of like, rather than taking your pet down to the vet to have it put down, this is like letting it loose on the open mountain road.
Oh, well, there it goes. And I imagine then that there will be an entire body of developers rushing at the system to try and tame it.
There may be, but the problem is that there's a few problems. First of all, HP hasn't actually said what sort of license it's going to be released under. There's some suggestions it might be under GPL, but no one's quite sure. Secondly, will the license and will the code include the patents that Palm held to develop WebOS? You know, various things will be patented within it, including sort of elements of the code, but also maybe some of the things such as the gestures that you use to get rid of Windows and stuff. And third, okay, you develop the software and you bring it up to a fantastic pitch. Now, where's the hardware for it to go onto? You know, you can't sort of say, okay, well, open source making a tablet, because that's a really difficult thing to do. There just is not the money around to do that.
And well, not even in manufacturing companies like China, where they're producing off the shelf white label tablets, like they're going out of fashion.
It's actually not as trivial as it sounds. You know, having some software that that runs WebOS, you know, you have to have firmware, you have to drive the tablet, you have to drive the screen, you've got to have the battery, you've got to source the parts, you've got to get them together, you've got to deliver them. It's the sort of thing where you've got to be doing it by the hundreds of thousands, really, to make it in the least bit economical. In which case, you might as well think, why not just buy an iPad or an Android tablet?
So this, in terms of the open sourceness of it, I want to get back to the licenses in a second. But in terms of the open sourceness of the software, this could potentially, at least conceptually, compete with something like an Android tablet, though.
Well, it's like loads of open source projects which are out there, and you know, they just sort of they sit there and quietly moulder away. The thing is that WebOS is no use unless it has hardware. There's lots of software out there which is great, you know, if it's being used to do something. But the thing about a platform and OS is that you have to have apps. I mean, BOS, back in the day, was a great OS. It was fantastic for multimedia, but it wasn't on anyone's computer. So, you know, it died, in effect. And this is much the same. The suggestion is that actually financially, it's just better for HP to do this because it means that they're not shutting down the division, in which case they'd have to pay lots of people lots of redundo.
What are the different licenses that you mentioned, and what are the implications for them?
Oh, it's alphabet soup. There's, it could be GPL, there could be LGPL, it could be GPL. PL3, it could be Apache, it could be, look but don't touch. Who knows? You know, because HP just hasn't been very forthcoming about it so far, and that's one of the things that people are seeking a bit of clarification about. But you know, it's indicative of how this is not about really making something that's going to be useful. That Megha Whitman didn't stand up and say, okay, so here's what's going to happen. We're going to put this money into a fund which will fund it, and all these people are going to go over there and work for it, and the company is constituted in X, Y, and Z, and it's going to have WebOS, which will be released under this license. They've had long enough. They could have made this decision if they really wanted to, because it's not as if there's no examples in the past of how to do an open source country. You know, you've got the Mozilla Foundation, which came out of the failure of Netscape, which was then open source, which then managed to bootstrap itself and become, you know, mildly profitable, I guess, if you would say. But they've done none of that. They've just said, yeah, we're going to open source it, I guess. If anyone wants to stay around and help do that, sure. Yeah, they're just letting the talent pool just go away.
So is there any indication of what HP is going to do now? Are they going to focus on PC manufacturing? Are they going to
They're really into PCs now. Yeah, it's very much back into the PC market.
I thought though that they were going to stop making PCs, that they were just going to be focusing on Windows tablets.
The Leo Apotheker suggested that they should get out of the PC manufacturing business because although the PC, the Personal Systems Group, is the largest division inside HP by revenue, it's one of the smallest by profit. They make about $40 profit for every $800 PC that they make. But Windows 8 tablets, they are suggesting they'll make two of those next year at least. So there seems to be some interest in doing that from HP. So you know, we'll see where it goes. But what you can be absolutely certain of is that there won't be any WebOS tablets next year.
Well, next we follow the never-ending saga of the Samsung-Apple disputes over device sales and patents. You may remember, and we covered on this podcast, that Apple has been trying to ban sales of Samsung devices in various countries around the world one by one. The bans have already been imposed in Australia and in Germany. But in the latest twist, Samsung have taken the fight to Apple by overturning the Australian ban while applying to get iDevices banned in France, with Italy potentially next. Charles, can you give us a brief summary of the background to this? I mean, what is Apple and Samsung's beef with one another? Is it just that the devices look like one another, or are there real threats?
This comes out of the fury, really, that Steve Jobs felt about Android and the fact that he felt that Android was copying a lot of stuff that Apple did. And so Apple has been going after HTC, which was the first to implement a number of the iPhone UI elements. And they've also been going after Samsung, particularly after Samsung, on the basis of copying, that the devices often look very similar to an iPhone or an iPad. And it has to be said that from the constellation of Android tablets, for example, if you look at the Samsung Galaxy 10 tab, that looks more like an iPad than anything else out there apart from an iPad. It has a silver surround.
It's massive as well.
Got an aluminium back. It's got the black edging. All those sorts of things. You go, wow, that's an iPad. Oh, no, it's not an iPad. Because the aspect ratio is slightly different. But those are the only elements where you would say that it particularly differs until you turn it on.
Well, but also Samsung make components for Apple, don't they? So where does this leave that relationship?
Samsung's a very big company which has all sorts of things like chip foundries and so on. So yes, they do make components. They make screens, I think. They supply chips, memory chips. But Apple is one of their largest customers. So this relationship is sort of one where Apple doesn't like the output, but they sure like, you know, other bits that they make. And their argument is that Samsung is perfectly free to make any sort of other device they'd like, as long as it doesn't look like what they call slavish copying of Apple devices. Samsung hits back and is basically trying to escalate the fight or negate the fight and basically have the two of them agree not to fight each other by trying to get the iPhone 4S banned in France, where it has failed initially, and Italy, where that's going to be heard presently.
Why have they chosen those specific countries, like Australia? Why have they chosen there and or France or Italy? Why?
Australia, because it's a big country, and because if you manage to get an injunction there, then it's useful in terms of how the patent system works in other countries. Italy and France, just because of the way that, again, that their court system works, how easy it is to get things heard, and the way the patent system operates. There is an ongoing fight in the US where Apple is has been taking Samsung to court over claims, again, that it slavishly copies Apple designs in various ways, and they have an enormous court document relating to it. And Apple is claiming that Samsung is dragging its feet over having various legal meetings they need to have in order to make the case happen. So it's the sort of thing which won't be decided, if it does get decided, until, you know, the earliest sometime next year.
And what about the UK? Could it come here?
The UK doesn't seem to have been affected, and I suspect it's down to sort of niceties in the arguments about what's called trade dress, that is, how something looks. So that hasn't been carried out in the UK. I mean, I don't think it can be because the UK isn't a big market. I think it must be more down to the difficulty of and the cost involved in getting these things done here.
So in the countries where it has been banned, ignoring the fact that in Australia the ban was overturned, but in the countries where these devices have been banned, is it illegal to sell them, or can the companies
they're banned, they're injuncted from selling them. So they have to change the design slightly, which is one thing that they've done in Germany, and they have what's now called the Samsung 10.1N. Tablet, which they say does not infringe the things for which they were injuncted the first time around.
What about the countries? What about the companies that that have them in stock? I mean, are they officially...
Can't sell them.
Can't sell them. Can they send them back to the manufacturer to have the N sort of scraped on there by an elf in the back room?
Well, yeah, possibly. I mean, I suspect Apple would be watching quite carefully to see whether these things really are. But yeah, for Samsung, it'd be sort of it goes out and then it comes back.
Well, finally, Google has announced that Android has racked up 10 billion downloads from Google Android Store, with the market now generating 1 billion downloads a month. Not bad. And 25% of those were for games. Interestingly, their data highlights that 9 p.m. on a Sunday night is the most popular time to install apps. So not watching X Factor. Is X Factor on at 9 p.m. on a... I literally have no idea. Not watching television, too busy downloading games. At the Le Web conference in Paris last week, Google's Eric Schmidt flagged up a new version of Android, Ice Cream Sandwich, and said that Android was going to be the platform to develop apps for. Well, of course he would. He's Google's Eric Schmidt. Now let's just explore that briefly. The success of apps has largely been down to Apple's App Store to date, with 18 billion downloads thus far. But is the size and the clout of the Android market, with 200 million devices and 500,000 more coming online every day, is this about to shift to their favor, Charles?
In terms of number of apps, absolutely, yeah. You can see that it's not going to take that long before the number of apps being downloaded from the Android market is going to be colossal. And, you know, you could say it'll be a billion a month, and then it'll be, you know, give it 6 months, it'll probably be 2 billion a month. And as more people come online, it'll be, you know, 3 billion, 4 billion, yeah.
Well, one of the early criticisms of the Android market was that the apps weren't vetted. You know, that was also one of the benefits for developers, for example, but that they weren't nearly as good as what you would find on the Apple App Store. How do you see this as shifting? Are the quality of the apps now as good as, if not better than, those that you can find on Apple's App Store? Or is it just simply that people don't have an Apple iPhone and therefore they don't really have a space for comparison?
My experience is that when I compare apps which have been written for Android, and when they're Android sort of originating apps which don't, for example, have a direct version on the iPhone, then the standard of the Android app tends to be lower. It's just not as good an experience. It's not as thought through. There's not the same sort of user interface thinking. If you look at things like Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, which are common to both those big platforms, then yeah, you know, the UI tends to be really similar, and they do very similar things. And you could think, hey, Android apps are always, you know, just as good. But it's when you get to sort of, you know, apps for doing stuff. I mean, I'm not including games here, but apps for doing stuff. Then you start to go, okay, this is slightly different. As far as the market not being curated by Google, this has two effects. Which is, first, yeah, there's loads of crap. Secondly, you get malware, which is something which really doesn't get talked about very much. But there are lots of apps out there which are basically put onto the market sometimes as Trojan horses, so they'll be totally innocent. We had Lookout explaining this recently, Lookout Security. They're totally innocent, and people download it a lot, and then the more harmful update is put in there, and everyone gets, oh, okay, just update it. Fine, okay, and bang, you've got a whole lot of phones which have, in effect, been you know, exploited. So there's a sort of, you know, there's a bit of an iceberg thing going on there in terms of what's really happening with Android. I mean, this is download. So, you know, how big and wide the market is, you know, that's not important, because this is about the number of downloads. But there's an interesting question to be asked, and I don't think anyone has the answer, which is how much use is made of these apps once they're downloaded. How much overlap is there? Is it always the same sort of core 5 or 10 apps? You know, how long is the long tail?
Is there any data for this? Because I imagine that the app developers would be chasing this information themselves, but I don't know if there's an aggregate. Is there?
You can see sort of rough numbers of downloads on the Google Market. It'll tell you for various apps how many downloads it's had. Apple is a bit closer with the information, but there's some information coming out about that, you know, which developers themselves can see. But I think for a lot of developers, it's much more about monetization, you know, and the Apple Store remains the better one for them for that, because it's difficult to get your credit card data, I think, onto the Google one, and to be entirely sure you trust the developers.
Well, this will be very interesting to bear in mind as we hear the interviews in the rest of this week's program. But before we get to those, here's a reminder that the news is on the site all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Back in August, BlackBerry's Patrick Spence, their global MD of sales and marketing, came into the studio and talked with Charles about the tortuous route app developers had to take to develop for BlackBerry's platform. Now, Charles, remind me what it was that he had to say.
It was basically that they're moving from BlackBerry 6 to BlackBerry 7, and they've also got an OS called QNX, which is used on the RIM playbook, and that they were going to try to move forward to a platform that would use a sort of hybrid of QNX on their next generation of smartphones, which will be coming out in 2012.
So this is all a pretty short period of time to try and get to know lots and lots of different operating systems.
They're packing it all in there in a very exciting way, I think you would say.
Exciting, that's spinning it nicely. I would call it very confusing. Well, keen to clarify the situation and explain how HTML5 will be part of the pathway, BlackBerry's Alex Saunders, Vice President of Developer Relations and Ecosystems Development, came in to speak with us. Now, this was recorded before BBX became BB10. And he started by explaining how developer relations are at present.
Well, I think that they're pretty good. Developer relations at RIM at the moment, we have a stable community of developers that are building applications for the product. I've been out talking to a lot of developers about some of the things that they've been hearing and how to think about what it is that's going on with RIM at the moment. And I really have had three key messages for them. One of them is that don't be confused by the market share numbers. The reality is that we went from 50 million customers a year ago to 70 million customers this year, and that's a great market that developers can sell to. And the second thing that I hear an awful lot is, people concerned that maybe they won't be able to build applications that are saleable. And it's really kind of interesting. BlackBerry happens to be an ecosystem where people are willing to pay for applications and where developers are actually doing good business building applications for BlackBerry. So just recently, a company by the name of Evans Data, it's an analyst firm, came out with a report that said that the average BlackBerry, well, sorry, not the average, 13% of BlackBerry developers have made more than $100,000 building applications for the platform. And when you compare that to some of the widely reported statistics you hear about other platforms, that's a pretty significant number. And then, of course, I mean, we've been talking an awful lot with developers about our future and our operating system directions.
The question I think that many people have asked and aren't quite sure about yet is how you're going to make the transition next year from the BBOS, the one that powers mm-hmm. BlackBerry's at the moment, to QNX, which at the moment is only available on the playbook, is only seen on the playbook.
The HTML5 strategy is the key to the migration strategy. If you build an application with HTML5, and we have the best HTML5 implementation on mobile today, if you build an application with HTML5, you can run it on BlackBerry 5, 6, 7. You can run it on Playbook. And, of course, you'll be able to run it on those future BBX devices. If you build an application for Playbook using any of the supported runtimes, and so that's HTML5 or the native C and C++ or any of the open source frameworks we use, that will also run on that future BBX platform. So that's the way that it's accomplished. There is a community of developers today that have built BlackBerry OS applications on Java. BlackBerry's Java development environment will not continue onto the BBX platform. So for those developers, they either will make a migration of their application, do a port of their application onto HTML5, or if it's an application which uses lower level components on the platform, they're going to have to look at the C and C++ with native option.
Those Java ones, do those tend to be enterprise apps or some of those bigger name apps, bigger selling apps?
There is quite a body of them out there because the HTML5 strategy for BlackBerry is only about 2 years old at this point. I think that in the case of enterprise, HTML5 is a very attractive option. Many enterprise managers are confronting the fact that users in their organizations are bringing in their own devices. And if you have to support multiple different devices inside your organization, HTML5 is a good answer because it lets you build an application that can be run across all those different devices.
The danger, though, surely for RIM is that if you have your developers starting to build with HTML5, then it becomes totally cross-platform and there's no tie-in to RIM's products anymore. You can effectively be pushed out by whoever happens to be cheaper this week or whoever happens to be the one that the people bring as their own device.
The way in which we are addressing that is by having the best HTML5 implementation that you possibly can have.
What's so good about it?
Let's just start with benchmarks. If you go to html5test.com and start to benchmark our devices, the implementation, the completeness of it, against other mobile devices, you'll see that we score very, very high. Especially on Playbook, the benchmark is almost at the level of a desktop operating system.
Stephen Alup, who took over at Nokia in September of last year, has, when he's been talking about Nokia's future strategy and their adoption of Windows Phone, he's been saying, well, we see three ecosystems, and he basically sees Apple, Android, and Windows Phone as their ecosystems. RIM simply doesn't get a look in when he's talking about it. Do you think that that's realistic?
You know, I wouldn't want to comment on Nokia's strategy. I mean, I think Stephen should comment on Nokia's strategy. I think it's to his advantage to ignore us, isn't it? But I think at the same time, you have to look at the fact that there are 70 million phones out there running BlackBerry OS today. You know, there is a good opportunity for developers. I mean, the facts just speak for themselves. I mean, people build software for BlackBerry and build businesses around it.
And how do you see the sort of shift? What sort of rate do you expect to see people porting their apps to QNX? Do you think there will be wholesale rewrites, or do you think people are just going to go for the sort of packaging of using the BBX strategy that you talked about?
Yeah. So we don't expect that people will rewrite them for QNX specifically. I mean, the BBX platform has QNX as the underlying OS, and obviously a great OpenGL implementation. What we're trying to do is take communities of developers that have existing source code bases and bring them onto the platform very quickly and very easily. It's the same strategy with the Android player. When Playbook OS 2 ships, it will come out of the box with the ability to play some number of Android applications. Not the entire suite, but about 70% of applications that are written for Android will be able to be ported onto the platform. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of that kind of activity where existing communities of developers bring their applications to Playbook.
But I mean, the Android strategy that you talk about for the Playbook, it seems to be neither fish nor fowl. It doesn't quite run the Android apps in a native way, and it can't quite run all the native apps. And it's sort of like you're being not quite an Android tablet, but sort of an Android tablet. It seems like as if you can't quite make up your mind what you want it to do. Because
That's by design.
You said it, not me.
The Android player is designed to run the open source version of Android. So anything which touches any of those licensable assets from Google, like Maps, like Gmail, I mean, we don't have a license from that from Google. So Google is playing this game where they talk about, yes, Android is open source, but it's not really. If you want the full experience as they've designed it, you're going to pay them a pile of licensing fees to get that. Nobody makes any money in the Android marketplace, but people do pay for applications on BlackBerry App World. So an Android developer can go from being a pauper to actually building a business. And if you're interested in building a business, then BlackBerry App World is the place to be.
That was Alex Saunders, Vice President, Developer Relations and Ecosystems Development from RIM. Now, next up is the lay of the land from the developer's point of view.
So I'm here with Tom Curtis of Bluevia and Peter Swain from Always On Message. Peter, you're chief executive at Always On Message. You've got a mobile agency and an app agency. Just explain to us what it is that you're looking to do in the mobile world.
Yeah, we try and help people understand what mobile's going to become a little bit and talk quite a bit about the disruption that mobile brings, both in terms of challenge and opportunities, and how companies can address those challenges and hopefully leverage the opportunities. And at the moment, that sits squarely with apps.
Do you find that companies are receptive to that sort of message? I mean, when you knock on the doors and say, you know, mobile is coming, mobile is going to make a difference, apps are going to be the principal way that these come in, are they actually taking that on board?
The message that we're going out to the world with is very simple. Do you wish to be a blockbuster or a love film? And you can look at the parallels from 10 years ago and see very, very quickly who took on board a technology and who ignored a technology. And mobile's doing exactly the same thing again. It's offering companies an opportunity to either jump 10 steps up the food chain very, very quickly. I mean, for example, I heard a good story recently of one of the taxi companies in London. Used to employ 2,000 cars until they introduced an iPhone app. And they now are employing 4,500 cars.
And what message do you, you know, how do you persuade them if you ever do persuade them? Or do you just say, well, I guess we can't do that one?
We don't, to be honest. It's a case of there's so much change happening and at such a quicker pace. It's, if you look at, again, going back to the internet model, you were talking 2-3 year cycles of change. So it was web one, then web two and social media and all this kind of wonderful stuff. Mobile is quarter by quarter change. So I don't really think we have time to sit around and say, well, are you sure mobile's going to affect you? Because there's so many people looking for our services and services in mobile and understanding of mobile and are either very excited or very scared that I'd rather go and talk to those people that have taken it on board and we will help them.
Tom, I mean, with Bluevia, you're sort of, it's almost like you're working in parallel with the individual apps available on each of the platforms. It seems like you're trying to go for something that's much more cross-platform. Is that right?
I would kind of agree with that. I mean, from our perspective, we need to provide, if we just look at, say, something like Carrier Billing, we need to provide developers with an access, a way of getting money, you know, full stop. Some developers do choose stuff like iOS, and obviously that's, you know, massively successful, but average revenues and stuff are, you know, beginning to drop, mainly because, you know, with 500,000 apps plus, you know, how do you stand out? How do you differentiate? And more importantly, how do you get a customer to buy your app? It's very difficult. So if we can provide easier ways to do that, you know, easier ways to monetize your product, then that's good. And there's some very interesting talks on, you know, Opera and how they're trying to get into the smart TV space. Very interesting, but, you know, how do you monetize that? You know, you're not really going to have a credit card associated with the TV yet. It'll probably happen, but how will it happen? You know, will Carrier Billing be that? Maybe, maybe not. It may be PayPal. But by exposing stuff and making sure it stands compliant, you know, developers can plug in where appropriate.
And the whole tenor of what you're talking about, I mean, traditionally, the carriers have been thought of as rather slow moving. And certainly, you know, until the iPhone, the carriers were almost seen as the block on things changing. Is that really altering now? Are the carriers really?
No, I think what Peter said in that the iPhone, you know, it was a paradigm shift for everyone, not just for app developers or customers. Telcos and operators in the past have been very, very stubborn, and they have blocked innovation. And SMS revenues are going down. Voice revenues are going down. People aren't really using operator app stores, at least in Western Europe. It's a nasty thing to admit, you know, that, you know, the market share is going. If you take, say, applications like WhatsApp, which is a SMS-style application that runs over data rather than sending text messages, and that could have been possible with operator APIs in the past, but they were phenomenally expensive. What we're trying to do with Bluevia is we make it free for the developer to use. End customer pays a small fee, so it's standard network rates. We're hoping to do something like in-bundle SMS next year. But, you know, by opening it up and just letting the developer, you know, play with it, so to speak, who knows what could happen? Because we have to admit to ourselves that we can do infrastructure like nobody's business. You know, we can, you know, connect countries really well. Making decent apps and services, you know, we're going to struggle with that because we're focusing on, you know, making great infrastructure.
You never hear the sentence anymore, which operator are you with? If you think back just 2-3 years ago, you can hear a conversation in a pub or a cafe, oh, are you with Orange, are you with Vodafone? That conversation does not happen anymore. The conversation happens of which handset do you have? That is how much things have changed. In 2-3 years, Bluevia, O2, Vodafone, etc. have gone from being the predominant player in mobile, the absolute recognised force of everything that you do, say, eat, consume, etc., to being a second-part player. And I think, personally, my opinion is Bluevia is a really important initiative. I think it's really key for the operators to work out how they exist in this new economy.
So two final questions, really, then. You've talked about apps, and obviously, you know, the app store for all the different platforms have been enormously important for small developers. But, I mean, Peter, you're talking about apps which are being developed by companies, which are ways of raising the profile. So you talked about the cab company. I mean, two questions. First of all, are we going to see an evolution where actually more of the apps that we see and perhaps the majority of the apps are sort of corporate ones, which are all about pushing a company forward? And secondly, is that just an intermediate stage, as a lot of people say, to HTML5 pages, or are we always going to have apps? Are apps always going to be the way that things are?
I think I could probably talk for half an hour on the native versus HTML5 subject, so I'm going to try and avoid it. But when we refer to apps, we don't refer so much as... We have a good a question that gets asked in the office. If you use a book as a doorstop, is it a book or a doorstop? And there's no right or wrong answer, but it's just an interesting way to pose the question. So if you use an HTML5 set of pages for a specific function, is it an app or is it a site? Now, I would still say it's an app because it's an application that's trying to achieve X, Y, Z. So when we use the phrase app, we're slightly different maybe from other companies. So we as we advocate openly, mobile web, Android, BlackBerry, iOS, depending on the right fit for the right job. So that's a semi-answer to the second question. The first answer is actually, I think the app stores are now almost as harmful as they are good to small developers. Because I don't know the exact statistic, but it's a very, very large percentage of, 80% plus of revenue goes to a very small number of publishers on platforms. The stranglehold that app stores have, and I understand why they do it from their perspective, it makes absolute sense. And the lack of the fact that Google brought in Android and therefore couldn't become a search engine for apps because they now focus on their platform. So the natural aggregator that was ready to stand in didn't stand in because they went in their own direction has led to a real problem. We were talking on the way over here. One of my developers genuinely believes apps should be free and yet genuinely believes that a coffee from a barrister is worth £4 or £5. That perception does exist, that digital content should be free. So yes, I think it's going to become more of a, fortunately, unfortunately, a corporate world, because I think the budget's going to have to get bigger, because the productions are going to have to step up to become noticed. There'll still always be the exception to the rule app that gets noticed because it's cool or funky or wonderful or interesting. But more and more and more, I think it will be the world and remit of corporations. I think that's kind of unfortunate. And finding new models, whether it's ad-supported or carrier-supported through Bluevia or something like that, that's going to be the challenge in 2012 for developers. One of the work we're doing at the moment is for a core banking company that have 650 banks worldwide. The investment that each of those banks is having to do to get their infrastructure up to scratch that we can hook into it, the budgets are tenfold that of the budgets for us to actually produce the mobile interface. We did a booking engine for someone and we had to facilitate the booking by email or by Jabber servers because they didn't have an API we could get to.
So would you say that's a question of it's their own fault because they haven't innovated and created these easy pathways?
I got slated for last year's AppSword actually because I was on a panel with the guys from EMI and Universal. And they were the head of innovation. And I said, you guys have kind of been a bit lazy, haven't you, really? And they both went, ooh. And I said, no, don't get me wrong. If I was your shareholders, I wouldn't have wanted you to be wasting money innovating. You were earning plenty of money. Everything was going well. It's just now the problem is you've now, instead of betting red or black, you've got to bet the house because you've got to find a new business model, whereas if you'd done it 5 years ago. So have they been lazy? No, because they didn't know what was coming. Is it on their duty now to get it done and get it done very quickly? Because if they don't, who knows what the next thing's going to be that they have to get prepared for?
Peter Swain from Always On Message and Tom Curtis from Bluevia. And you can find all their links on the Tech Weekly page at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Finally, this week, Charles, you caught up with Cameron Yule from Adgent Digital. Who are they and what do they do?
They're a Silicon Valley-based company who buy up spare ad inventory. So if you are a UK site and you have lots of US viewers, then if you're selling your ads in the UK, you have lots of US viewers. Basically, there's no point in showing them lots of UK ads. So you have what's called inventory, that is space on your site being viewed by US viewers. And what they do is they say, okay, well, we can sell that space for you to US advertisers. So they go around and they buy up this spare inventory, as it's called. And of course, they do this all over the world. They do this for lots of different places, lots of different countries. They even do it for, as they will explain, places like China. One of the things they're looking at now, though, is using HTML5 to develop a next generation of ads because of what's been announced about Adobe and Flash. So they're not just a sort of a what do you call it, a reseller or a sort of a recycler of ad space. They're also looking forward at what's going to be happening in the future of the ad space on the web. So when he came in last week, I asked him to tell us a bit more about the company.
Adjunct Digital is a company we started about 4 years ago. Originally, the idea was around international IPs on premium publications. So imagine someone accessing The Guardian from New York. Up until we came along, they'd see an ad that was relevant to London. And then we decided that that was a big opportunity, particularly on premium publishers. Over the course of the last 4 years, we've developed a lot of technology. We have a video ad platform that's used by the top 50 publishers in the United States. We have Tweetology.com, which is a curation system we built for Twitter that's used by a lot of brands and a lot of publishers.
In terms of the way that people are accessing sites and how they're coming to them now, there's been a big shift to mobile in the past few years, hasn't there?
Yep.
Which is sort of making up an increasing percentage. It's not by no means a majority yet, but it's a important percentage of many sites' views. Adobe recently said that it's going to cease development of the Flash plugin for mobile, which seems to open up space for HTML5. Are the advertising platforms ready there?
They're not. They're not. The short answer is they're not. I think you'll see some pretty big developments in HTML5 and over 2012. We as a company are taking that bet that we think HTML5 is the platform, and we're bringing a lot of tools to market to help publishers and brands and creative houses, for that matter, create HTML5 ads. The mobile, it's a huge opportunity. I'm a firm believer that tablets are here to stay. That's the way we're going to access our content going forward. It's I'm much more on the tablet side than the mobile device. I still like a mobile phone, an iPhone, for example. I still think the content experience isn't that great. But once you get into tablets and the Kindle Fire, 2012, I think we'll see some pretty significant growth there. And I think it's the way we're going to all access our content going forward. So we're as a company, we believe in the space, and we believe wholeheartedly in HTML5, and we're taking a big bet on it.
What's the form of the big bet? What have you done there?
We're doing several things. We're building a platform that enables publishers and media houses and brands to effectively create HTML5 ad units. So we're doing that. We're building an analytics platform on the back of that as well. So we think it's the great leveler. The experience isn't that great today on the iPad when you're on any site. If you click onto any bit of content or an ad, you're taking you're switching out pages, and it's not a great experience. HTML5 changes that completely. You remain on the page. You can get a lot of content inside the ad unit. It is a game changer.
So the whole sort of thing where if you click on an ad, I mean, people are all scared to click on ads, I think, because they feel they will get whirled away from where they were and taken to somewhere entirely different, which they didn't necessarily want to be on. You're suggesting that HTML5 will mean you can actually just stay on the same page, you just expand the capabilities a bit, perhaps compared to what you were seeing before.
Yeah, well, you can take over the space, the page, without taking you off the page. So you can take an ad unit, let's say it's an MPU ad unit, a pretty standard internet ad unit that people don't particularly like clicking on, and you can turn that into a page very easily with a lot of content behind it, including video, booking engines, all that sort of thing, without ever taking somebody off the page. And all they've got to do to get rid of it is push it back into the corner or slide it back into the corner with touch on the iPad. It's a game changer. And then that from a brand point of view, you got to start thinking about, I'm not trying to drive somebody back to my site and back to my booking engine or back to a micro page, a microsite. What I'm trying to do is actually capture that person in the moment, give them some content that's relevant or the tools to do something, book whatever it might be, or buy something, all within one ad unit. We're finally getting to the promise that we've all talked about for 15 years, right? This is where consumers begin to interact with content and advertising, and they will do so, as much with the advertising as with the content, because the advertising can be content, right? And without interrupting the flow of experience, it's going to be a much, much better experience, and there's going to be a lot more dollars flowing into digital over the course of the next few years as brands wake up to the opportunity, publishers wake up to the opportunity that's in front of them, and it's really where digital takes over, I think.
Some commenters say, I'm so happy with my flash blocker because it means I don't have to see ads. There's almost a sort of fear of HTML5 because they say, well, I won't be able to block HTML5. You know, where do I go now? How do I stop it? Is that a rational thing? Is that actually the sort of triumph for the advertisers that it's not blockable?
Yeah, every time someone mentions things about blocking ads, the general consumer may or may not want to see advertising, right? But at the end of the day, advertising is what drives the ability for them to access free content, and whether it's their Facebook page, which is all paid for by an advertiser, or it's The Guardian. You know, at the end of the day, blocking ads is a dumb idea from a consumer's point of view, because at the end of the day, they'll have to pay for the content if they want the content.
In terms of internet users, China is actually the biggest country. How does it go about trying to get the inventory and sell the inventory there?
Yeah, China. We're the first guys that placed media on ChinaPeoplesDaily.com, the first Western company. It's very difficult. There's several problems with China. Firstly, the firewall. And then China, they don't sell the media the way we do in Western countries. Firstly, you're not allowed to have third-party tags, so you can't track anything that's put up there. You buy on day part, so you might want the front page of any publication between the hours of 11 and 12 on Fridays, for example. That's the way they buy media. It doesn't matter how many impressions they get or not, you're going to be charged a flat rate for that. So it's a different scenario. We do a bit of stuff up in China, but it's pretty difficult. And when you back out to an ECPM, you're getting very, very low numbers.
ECPM being electronic clicks per thousand.
Yes, exactly. It's the average across. So it makes it very difficult to prove the business model out for China. I mean, if you're in China just doing media inside China, I'm sure there's a relative good business. But cross border stuff because of the firewall make it very difficult.
Cameron Yule from Adgent Digital. Well, that's it for this week. And as I said earlier, next week we're finishing up the year with our annual Christmas show, some of the bloopers of which from today's program will, of course, be included at the end of that program. You can expect chaos and the usual round of public humiliation thanks to the blooper outtakes. If you would like to add your tuppence for Story of the Year, and please Technology Story of the Year, then do send us an email or tweet us or comment on our Facebook page. All of the links are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Until then, thank you very much to Charles Arthur, to Scott Colley, our fearless producer, and I am Alex Krotowski. Thanks to you for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.